Hey, lovely RCP listeners. Well, we wanted to just thank you for your incredible support and response to our series with Jess Hill about her book, See What You Made Me Do, and our discussion regarding coercive control. And many of you asked that we interview Rosie Batty. And so I reached out to Rosie and was absolutely delighted that she agreed to come on Real Crime Profile. Now, these episodes are incredibly hard listen. They are intense as Rosie talks for one of the first times in a long while about her son, Luke, who was murdered aged 11 by his father on the 12th of February 2014 in Australia. So I just wanted to give you a trigger warning as we get into the detail about what happened, which is incredibly important that we do because we must understand the inextricable links between domestic abuse and child abuse. And just how dangerous coercive control is, and more so that it's largely not being identified as a high risk factor to serious harm and homicide. That's what we want to change. And so I wanted to let you know that in the wake of Hannah Clark and her children, Alia, Leanna, and Trey's horrific murders in February 2020, that I've launched a petition in Australia to criminalise coercive control. And if you would like to be an activist and add your signature to the petition, that would be wonderful. It's going to be in our show notes, so you can click on the link and add your signature. And there's also links in the show notes and at the end of these episodes if you're experiencing domestic abuse or stalking and if you need help and advice. So don't feel that you're alone. Please don't suffer in silence. There's help out there for you. And there's the link to the Dash Risk Checklist website. So without further ado, here's our interview with Rosie Batty.
With horrific domestic violence homicides, it's understandably common for us men to say how appalled we'd be if that violence were inflicted upon our wife, our sisters, or our daughters. We've all heard men say these words in the wake of yet another woman killed, the names of whom come across my desk all too regularly. What we don't say enough is how appalled we'd be if our brothers, our sons, or our mates had caused that death or injury to someone they claimed to love. I say this because of one unavoidable fact. Overwhelmingly, the perpetrators are men. On average, one woman is murdered every 9 days in Australia by her current or former partner, with most killed within 90 days of the end of the relationship. If men are responsible for the lion's share of abuse, why is it that we simultaneously carry out the smallest proportion of advocacy and leadership? The overrepresentation of women rests on them not just as victim survivors, it also rests on them as advocates, experts, and frontline service providers. I've met countless extraordinary women in my role as minister. Last week, for example, I visited South Coast Domestic Violence Services, all of which were staffed by women with impressive knowledge, compassion, and unwavering dedication. Turning our attention to male behaviour, male intervention, and male prevention, that spotlight can make a substantial difference. You can refer men who may be using violence to support and counselling services. Let them know there's no shame in seeking help. Drag down the barriers around mental health, drug or alcohol abuse. Call out disrespectful attitudes. Cultural change can be slow. It can take a long time. But that's all the more reason that we need to act. For every man hearing this, the time to act is now. For confidential advice, support and referrals related to domestic and family violence, contact 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. Or the Men's Referral Service, 1300 766 491.
Rosie Batty is nothing short of extraordinary, having turned unspeakable tragedy into a force for good. In 2014, her 11-year-old son Luke was murdered at the hands of his father in a brutal and very public assault. And from that moment on, Rosie has been instrumental in bringing domestic violence to the public's attention, becoming an unexpected advocate for the thousands of voiceless victims.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, author of the book Policing Domestic Violence and of the DASH risk assessment model.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
And today we are joined by a very special guest, somebody who by popular demand, our listeners, you asked us, and I responded to you and I reached out to an incredible woman who's joined us today. And it's...
My name is Rosie Batty, and I live in Victoria, Melbourne, Australia. And I had the unfortunate experience of my son being murdered 6.5 years ago now by his father. And since that moment in time, I have spoken out against violence towards women and children and haven't really stopped in all that time.
You've been a continuous advocate, and we really appreciate your work, and we really wanted to talk to you because so many of our listeners asked us to have the conversation, in particular because we've been talking to Jess Hill. So thank you so much for coming on to Real Crime Profile, and let's dive straight in and you can tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing.
We're supposed to be these cowering, timid little people that just are intimidated constantly about the violence that we're managing. That may be for some people, that may be at moments, but there's a whole spectrum of different responses at any given time. But we become very good at recognizing from the look in that eye, from that body posture, from that particular time, this is not the time to push it. This is the time to diffuse the violence. This is the time to do whatever you can to diffuse the violence. And it becomes innately within you as a survival skill. So you have developed a survival skill. So what you're now saying is, I have to ring the police, and you've got your friends telling you, you've got everybody telling you, your family telling you, and then they switch off from you because you're not. And then they turn their backs on you because you don't do what they say, because they've got the advice. They don't understand risk. They have not taken their time to understand the dynamics. They just know that he's a loser. He's doing this stuff. You need to do something about it. I had this with my relationship of that time that was for 5 years. He said, I don't know what you're supposed to do, Rosie, but you should be doing something. Now, he wasn't willing to call this crisis support line to understand that I was indeed doing what I could do, because it wasn't enough. And you see, so he was victim blaming me. I didn't even have the language for that. I just thought, this is great, isn't it? I've got an ex-partner making my life miserable. I've got a current partner who's blaming me. And I have the little boy who's caught up in all of this. And in the end, what matters the most is that little boy. And if that means I have to extricate myself from a relationship that is not able to put him first, then that's what I have to do. So there's all these choices you have to make. Yeah. And you're always making them, well, I can say, trying to put the child first, trying to make sure that his emotional well-being, that I wanted him to become a well-balanced, compassionate, emotionally intelligent, kind man. And I did everything to try and encourage and enable that. And it was because I didn't want him to pick up and repeat the violence of his father. And so I did that for the whole entirety of his life. And one of the comforting things that I do have to hold on to is, it was interesting, just a few weeks and months before he got killed, some of my friends had actually bumped into him selling raffle tickets at Scouts and things like this. And he was so mature and respectful and said, how are you? And they said, Rosie, Luke has just matured into this lovely kid. And I thought, I'm getting there. I'm winning. He's going to be that person. And what's sad, incredibly tragic, is that's why Greg chose to do it, because he felt he'd lost that control over Luke, or that Luke had become somebody that, and all it was he was 11 and a half. He was on the cusp of adolescence. They want their own friends. They don't want mum and dad. They want to start to explore and do things independently. And as a parent, that's what you start to support and enable in a safe way.
Right.
So I have no doubt that Greg chose that moment in time deliberately, because he was on the cusp of reaching the next phase of his life. He was no longer the little boy. And this is the cruelty. These are the reflections I have to sit with as I work through in my own way and understanding, and sit with that harsh reality. So this resistance to ring the police when you still don't know and cannot trust, even though the culture of the police has improved enormously. But what are we coming from? We're coming from zero acknowledgement of domestic violence being a human rights issue, being a reason for police business. We've come a long way, but gee whiz, we've still got a long way to go. And if I'm an Aboriginal woman, I've got absolute genuine reasons, because if I involve the police with the way that child protection operate, I will still potentially end up with my child being removed from me. And the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people, and particularly women and children, in the system is our national shame. Mm. So we have significant barriers and reasons to not trust. And what we do need to do is continue, as you are so rightly saying, listen with genuine intent to the people in the system, the people whose lives have been impacted, so that we can continue to learn. And how genuine is that still? I hear and see a lot within the circles where I work of consumer voice, lived experience voice, but we still have to be a certain way. I have been able to be heard in ways that I know many victim survivors will never. And the profile of being Australian of the Year, which you would never know in the UK because you don't have UK Person of the Year, but in Australia, it is a great honour. It is a really great privilege. And I can say I took that opportunity and immersed myself in it. And I actually am potentially the most memorable Australian of the Year for many people, because I didn't see it as an award that I just took and thanked people on the podium. I actually took it as a role, and I spent I spent at least 3 years traveling extensively, speaking at nearly every opportunity, but not randomly. This was strategic on my behalf. I spoke to all of the people that are involved in a victim's journey. Police and magistrates, professionals. Family violence is not even a serious subject studied by social workers even. Never mind police training and all the rest of it back then. So how can we possibly understand the complexities and unpack the myths and challenge our pre-existing attitudes if we never get those opportunities? And yet, why, if you've got 1 in 3 women experiencing family violence and physical violence, 1 in 4 children, and 1 woman will be murdered, why would you not see that nearly every profession dealing with community in any form should have improved understanding of how to better respond and support and people who are experiencing the violence? And then go even further, of course, to shift that conversation from why doesn't she leave to why has he chosen to be violent, and why are we condoning it, and why have we tolerated it, and why have we not made them accountable? And I'm pleased to say that I think that conversation is happening more frequently.
can't help but think that some intervention may have just been enough for him to rethink, or maybe enough of a red flag for me to understand what acute danger Luke and I were in.
When I train police and all sorts of professionals actually on the dash, I train them on communication skills, because actually, Rosie, you're spot on. I talked to a detective sergeant last week, and he said, and he's a very good detective sergeant, he said, it's not difficult, is it, Laura? We just have to listen, and we have to understand. We have to do your training. We have to ask the right questions, and then we have to act. It's really not that hard. And I say, if we could clone you a million times over, because his level of communication skills and getting it was brilliant. But that should be the standard, really.
Well, we've got, again, I think Victoria is lucky to have a very progressive government. They're under a lot of heat at the moment, but I have to say, without that leadership that initiated the Royal Commission and supportive, and I know I played a big part in that, this is a 10-year plan. It's very difficult to see overnight change. It's a journey. It's a long journey. We've had brilliant leadership within our senior leaders in the police, and particularly our previous police commissioners. Great leadership. The cultural change, because it's about cultural change. It's not just about training, is it? One of as many police people as you can. It's about cultural change that is really a science in itself. To create any different culture. In Victoria, they've restructured the police. There are some really great and very interesting, but really committed police leadership in this area. And they've got a simulated training facility. So I know that they are really looking at this, that it's not going to change overnight. And I have continued hope that we will continue to evolve and improve, because it's who are we hiring? What types of people are we hiring? And as we look at even still the pushback, and I have a very high regard from someone, and I won't mention any names because he's very well recognised and known, but he's in a lovely man and he's been incredibly supportive to me, but I was astonished at his resistance to women in the police force. And that the pushback and mistrust about women being able to hold their own equally within the police force, because it always seems to come back to physicality. And that is, and because of women, they'll be at greater risk. And so I was like, oh my gosh, I hadn't expected that. And yet that would be typical of generational attitudes. But how important it is to not just have gender equality in the police force, but to actually have diversity within the police force. Mm. We need to continue to build those culture, to have that culture of inclusivity and diversity. And that's the end. That's a long, long game, isn't it? And I think that in the end, most of us go to work believing we're doing the best we can in the situation we give in the situation we're in, with the tools, knowledge, and training we have. And I think that now you are able to make the police more accountable, because people are filming what's going on. We've seen that, haven't we? We've seen that terribly demonstrated in the States. But there is so much good work as well. There are so many great police. And I think this is one of the reasons why body-worn cameras, potentially, in my opinion, would be very helpful, because what we have is a situation that unfolds with the scenario as it stands, potentially able to hold police accountable as well, or everybody. But the risk to that too is that victims are also put in a place, and I know I was, where I could look deranged. I could look like the angry respondent. I could look at the verbally abusive person and the perpetrator, because he did this to me constantly, make themselves look calm, cool, collected, look at what I have to deal with. She's an unfit mother. She's not. He did that with me too. So how do we, this is so complex. What a difficult job it is for the police coming into a situation, trying to read the scenarios that are in front of them in sometimes a highly dangerous environment,
right,
making the right choices and decisions. I mean, let's cut them a break. This is really tough. But it is about, I think, Laura, constant reflection, being able to see beyond what you saw as the obvious and the only scenario, and a perspective that you couldn't have seen without that opportunity to debrief or reflect. Or and that's where lived voices can help in a very meaningful way to understand those different perspectives, because that is your truth, isn't it? Everybody's perspective is their truth until they have the possibility of seeing it through somebody else's eyes.
Well, I think for the police, I mean, having worked in them for 10 years and Jim worked in the FBI, but for me, one of the key pieces that we really tried to bring in was professional curiosity. At New Scotland Yard, we had public inquiry after public inquiry. Mm. Victoria Climbier, one of our very high-profile cases, I lived through all of the very high profile public inquiries. The professional curiosity part was missing. I always say, if I could give the police one pill that would be transformative, it would be a professional curiosity pill to ask more questions. And you're right, there are some really good people. I've worked with some brilliant professionals across my career, but I don't feel they're rewarded enough. I don't feel that there's a promotion culture that rewards people doing this difficult work of domestic violence, stalking, sexual violence. I feel a lot of the awards go to other people doing terrorism work and more kind of, you know, high
and
profile.
And homicide.
And homicide, and not to the people who are really grafting hard, trying to keep victims alive, which is the trickiest stuff. Yeah. And that's really why I brought the dash in. It was the conversation. Yeah. My deputy assistant commissioner said, well, all of your research on profiling these dangerous offenders, Laura, how are you going to help the late term van driver at 3 a.m. when she goes out to attend a call out to domestic violence events? And I had to think for a minute, how am I going to help at 3 a.m. is by creating some conversation to have. And that's really where the dash was sparked from how do we mainstream this and help our officers get better at what they do. And I think there have been a lot of improvements, but we have to accept that within any workforce, you get misogyny, you get racism, you get all sorts of isms that we have to call it out when we see it. And you mentioned Hannah Clark's case, and I have to say, I, you know, watched what was happening unfold with absolute horror, not just in terms of how the media reported on it, and I discussed it a little bit with Jim and Lisa, but also how one of the officers came out and spoke to the media for 15 minutes, and in the middle...
That a man was pushed beyond the brink.
Was that the case?
Some years ago, that wouldn't have even been noticed as an inappropriate comment, never mind challenging. We sit there now and go, how could he say that? How could anyone say that? Because that could have easily come from a female police officer too. This is because, again, it's patriarchal culture, isn't it? It's not necessarily just that particular individual that thinks that way, but ultimately you have all these people from the sector, from within the police, hearing that and saying, oh my gosh, that we have to do something about that. That cannot go... that cannot be undone. And we're doing that with certain other things as well, with certain high-profile sports commentators and in the football culture and all of those things. But I do think that in my experience, I dealt with, after Luke had died, very senior people in the police structure, very senior, amazing men. And you could see why they got to where they were. And then you look at the recruitment process and the training and the culture of who the new police and the new style of policing we need them to be. But then what I've realised is you've got that middle tier that are never going to make it into the upper echelons because they either haven't got the career aspiration or they haven't got the talent. And then they sit. And that's the culture then that the new recruits go into. And if it's a regional and remote area, that's the boys' club. That's the culture. And they look out for each other. And again, another added layer of, because it's quite remote or it's quite regional, and you've got nowhere to go. And particularly if it's one of them that is committing the violence and abuse as well, it's really hard. So look at how do we change the culture? And I don't know that we can, of those who are perhaps well established in the police force. It's been a certain way for a very long time. And some people you can't change, you can't take over that line, and they're going to see it out. But I guess as we continue to build the culture from the bottom up.
Yeah, education, and the next generation will come in, hopefully having a more nuanced and actually informed perspective, and so that the old boy system doesn't just keep churning on. And obviously the whole world is dealing with this exact issue right now, and it's a very big one.
There remains a serious epidemic across our nation. No matter where you live, family violence exists in every pocket of every neighbourhood. It does not discriminate, and it is across all sections of our society. Family violence may happen behind closed doors, but it needs to be brought out from these shadows and into broad daylight. One in six women has experienced physical or sexual abuse by a current or former partner, including some of those celebrating with us today. One in four children, and at least one woman a week is killed. Indigenous women experience even greater family violence. These statistics are unacceptable, indisputable, and if they did happen on our streets, there would be a public outcry.
Throughout my career in the FBI, I dealt, unfortunately, with a number of parents who lost children. And I will say that unequivocally, I find the parents who survived that, who went on to try to help others that so that they don't go through the same thing, are heroic. And I just want to say that you are absolutely heroic for what you've done. And we just can't thank you enough for being there. And I don't know what your belief system is or anything, but I'm sure that Luke is proud of you and the work that you're doing. And there's a lot of other Lukes around who are still alive because you're doing what you're doing, and others still to come that will be saved because of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. And it's a really, it's so important that we all pull together, police, and I've worked with some amazing people, whether it's within government, whether it's within the sector, whether it's the police, who genuinely want to keep working towards change. I think what I've had to accept and realise is that the change is incremental. Mm-hmm. And the change I'd hoped that by some miracle could occur immediately after Luke's death, you realise as you kind of enter this space and you passionately involve yourself, you don't realise how many people have been working for decades in this area and who have never had government ear, never mind funding, where the refugees had to be secret and to keep them safe because the police would tell the perpetrator where the women were. The community didn't want to know. We're unsupportive. And again, the same backlash towards the women. And you realise the journey of that movement to keep women safe.
No, but sometimes it takes something as horrific as Luke's murder to actually jolt the public into making a significant step forward. And I think you really have been part of that.
The challenge for us who are invited and able to contribute because of the experience we've had is how do we keep moving forward without that trauma limiting us and pigeonholing us? And that's where I'm at, I guess, because you still have to work out how am I going to earn an income to support my life, to actually enable me to live. People don't even think of that. They ask you to speak, and often it's not been with any idea of how does this person support themselves? Have they got a job? What are they doing? And so for me, this is another real understanding about advocacy too, is we willingly ask, and we're very mindful of the sensitivity and respect required, but we take a lot as well. We take a lot. And so now there's an appreciation, I think, of certainly within government, well, as we keep asking people about their experience of something, how are they supporting themselves and what can we do to... And so I think that the journey is not an easy one for a victim advocate. And when we start on this, we genuinely feel we can change the world. And then it's easy, I think, to perhaps feel used or to feel exploited. Mm-hmm. Or undervalued and not listened to.
Yeah.
Because you don't always see the change that you had envisaged it to be. And I remember when Luke was murdered that night saying, I've joined a club no one wants to join. And I thought, how am I going to live with everybody publicly looking at me and saying, that's Rosie Batty. What happened to her? And having an opinion about me, having a judgment about me, but recognizing me. And how do I go back to having some normal kind of life? And yet I chose to speak out and I chose to put myself in that place. But when you do that, you don't realize the ongoing nature of being that tragic celebrity. And that is what I have been called by some disgruntled ex-politicians who've got no credibility left. The tragic celebrity who seeks to benefit from her son's death.
Wow.
And so,
oh my God.
That's so wrong. It's victim blaming. I mean, you didn't choose this. You're actually speaking out as a result of it.
And again, the opinions from people who have never heard you speak, never attended anything that you've, never listened to anything you've said, but have an assumption about you that is based on their own misogyny.
Right.
That they have. But that type of unfair, ugly dialogue that does get shown, does come out, is another opportunity. It's always an opportunity to balance that and to call it out and for those voices who need to challenge it to come through. And people do that on your behalf. And we need to see more men doing that rather
Absolutely.
Than it being the typical feminist Nazi calling that out.
I try to do what I can. And Laura has been vilified just like you have been as a man hater. And she's clearly not. She's just literally trying to protect women and children who are vulnerable. And that's
bringing men on that same journey.
And there's plenty of men who absolutely are on that journey, but unfortunately not all.
I haven't spoken about this actually for a long time. And so you you created an environment where I actually was okay to do it. One of the things that I've had to acknowledge and understand is how deeply I've been affected by trauma and PTSD and that acute anxiety, how it has affected me at times and how that has reflected and looked for people who haven't understood and the judgment or the breaking of down of relationships because of my mental health. And so that's why I'm saying this is a difficult journey and people with lived experience don't always, I think, realise the extent of our, when I say damage, I don't mean that to demean us, but actually it puts us in a position where we're reflecting honestly, but how that actually can work against us too. And if you, so it's actually been okay to talk about those things. I have been okay doing it, but for a period of time, I had to stop.
Yes.
I had to stop.
That's understandable, yeah. Rosie. I mean, I work with the Clough family. The minute their daughter had been murdered, and they jumped into advocacy and speaking out, and it was what they needed to do. And John and Penny have been incredible, but they've had to take a step back too.
Yeah.
Now's the time. And we talked about that.
Yeah.
And I fully supported them in that decision, because of course they have to grieve. They have to go through their process.
They do. And what you don't realise is you're being triggered all the time. So, yes. Yeah, so thank you for your understanding. And I hope that you gained what you needed to from the podcast today.
Well, we just wanted to talk with you, and there was no set narrative. And I'm glad we could hold space for you and allow you to talk. I was very conscious of that. You were in flow, and it's your journey as well. And that's what we wanted to hear about. And that's what our listeners will want to hear about. And I do hope there's room for some, we call it post-traumatic growth, because there can be real growth and positive things on the personal level that can come out. And I've seen it with families that I've worked with at catastrophic events that have happened. And I really hope that you find space for you in amongst all the incredible advocacy work that you've been doing on behalf of Luke and helping so many
other people. Well, that's exactly what I'm recognised for, Laura, which actually sometimes I find uncomfortable to be acknowledged in that way. But that is, I am an example of post-traumatic growth. It is then, how can I make this sustainable? How do I draw more life into my life? How do I make it that not 7 days a week I'm talking about family violence, that actually I can... Well, Nellie Thomas is a quite well-known comedian here in Victoria, and I did a podcast with her recently. She said, bloody hell, you're funny, Rosie. She said, I knew that when I first met you, we were on stage, wherever, and she said, we cracked some jokes between us, and she said, you're funny. She said, not many people would get that about you. And I said, well, all Luke wanted to be remembered by, he always wanted to be the funny guy. He would be very annoying to his teachers because he was always trying to make people laugh and act out. But he would have turned 18 in June, and we were in that small window able to have a few select people to come. And I decided to kind of open up to celebrate. And I said to a couple of his friends, that they were friends from prep, what do you think? I asked them about Luke, and they said, oh, we reckon he'd have a mullet. And I said, a mullet? Why do you think he'd be wearing a mullet? And they said, because he'd be making people laugh. He would be doing it to make people laugh. He was the funny guy. And that's what he, and so for me, I thought, he's been remembered in the way that he always wanted.
Oh.
And that gave me comfort. Pain, but comfort. Because I was scared his memory would go and no one would remember him. But you let go of that need to keep him alive. You do lessen that. I no longer try to control what happens with people's memories of Luke. That's their journey. And I'm comfortable enough to know that those who were in our lives will always remember him in their own way. And I don't have to worry about him being forgotten.
Aww.
And and so it's an ongoing journey. And as you say, and what I try to be, as people ask me to speak about resilience or courage or leadership, I try to be honest, because I don't want people to think that I've got life worked out, that person that was awarded and they seen speaking and then can command that kind of respect and regard by speaking to a few hundred or thousands of people. I'm still human. I'm still flawed. I'm still have self-recrimination. I still every day work out or what could I have done? It's an inner dialogue, an inner critic that is exhaustive. So you're still going through life, still trying to work out to be the best person you can be. So I don't want people to think I've got it worked out. This life is a journey. It's a journey of learning. And what we thought, or what I thought maybe 10 years ago is different to what is not perhaps the same. And I can't imagine where we'd be, where we will be in our retirement when we look at how far we've come as a community or as a society. So I just feel that that's what keeps me going, is people like yourself reaching out to me, exploring conversation, exploring opportunity to create change. And it's great to know that I'm still... My response or my perspective is still valuable.
So thank you, Rosie, so much for your time. This has been quite a tough conversation at times. There've been moments where I've been nodding along furiously to things you've been saying, and other parts where my heart's just been feeling like it's being crushed and I can't breathe, and goodness knows how it feels for you. But I think it's a really important conversation for everybody to listen to in Australia, in America, UK, all around the world. And we really appreciate your time. We want to keep Luke's memory alive, and we'll use the hashtag, his name was Luke Batty. And I hope that you're okay with that. I recommend for our listeners to read your book as well. And maybe we'll have you back on RCP to talk about your work at White Ribbon and just some of the things that you're trying to achieve there, and in particular about coercive control, as we kind of touched on that, but we didn't get fully into it. So I'd love to talk to you more about that. But for now, this is Real Crime Profiles signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.